you know, restart. That's the first lesson of technology. Turn it off and restart it.
We're both recording now.
Great. All right. We are now on the record. Again, thank you for your patience on the technical difficulties here. All right. A few announcements I wanted to make. Again, scheduling. Today's session, we scheduled to go on to 4:30 if need be. We may not need to. It depends kind of where the comments go and questions. The next meetings, then we're going to be off in August, and then September 6th, 2 to 5 o'clock. You may recall a while back, I had mentioned that the BEGA, the Government Ethics Office for DC, wanted to do a presentation for you all. And they have been able to find time from 4 to 5 o'clock. So the last portion of that meeting on September 6th, 4 to 5 o'clock. So 2 to 4 we do the rest, and then 4 to 5. For those who are able to be here, yes, there will be an ethics training for similar, if not the same, I suspect, as what the Sentencing Commission may have received. I know years ago they came and did one. Years ago. They apparently, the current staff have told me that they like to do this yearly with everybody. So I'll just put that out there. If you have follow-up questions, we can follow up individually. If you're not available, just let me know. So we have the September 6th meeting, and then September 19th also. July 21st, coming up fairly soon, is the deadline for any written comments on the first draft of report number 6 and number 7. They're also on the agenda today to discuss if there are any questions. This is regarding enhancements and attempt liability. What else to say? The end of this month, so after those comments are received, we'll look those over. And planning the end of this month, it may go into the first week of August, plan to get out property offenses for your review. It's going to be one large package. It'll be kind of divvied up into some different parts so that the document isn't too forbidding. But expect that here in a few weeks. And should be a similar in some respects to what you've kind of seen and worked on in years past. We're trying to do more offenses. We'll be covered in this. Things like commercial piracy. Some things which lend themselves to the kind of topics at hand of fraud and theft and the core offenses. Again, expect that here at the end of July as the kind of next big set of recommendations for your review.
When will the deadline for comments on draft number 2 of Report 5 be due? Do you know yet?
Draft number 2, second draft of report number 5. Second draft of report number 2, is that what you're thinking?
Well, it's report number 5. So we did not provide comments on that, probably because I goofed.
On the first round.
We will try to do is play catch up on that to the extent that we can, or we just might never catch up on that one.
For the offense.
So I'm trying to figure out if we can prepare to do that for a second draft.
It's not going to be, it'll be a while until we get out a second draft of that, just because, today we'll just kind of talk about the comments that we received even on the first draft. And then, we're really focused right now on these property offenses. So, second drafts on a number of these general provisions that we've kind of talked about will be, I think, forthcoming possibly in September, possibly later. We have a lot of agreement, frankly, on a lot of these issues, right? And it's more a matter of kind of tweaking the language. So, frankly, I have been less concerned about, at least so far, kind of trying to get a second draft of those versus keeping our timeline moving forward on the other fences. So I'll keep you posted, but right now the idea is the next release of anything will be the property fences here at the end of July. Last thing I wanted to say, I sent an email out this morning with the PDF of the ALI's new final set of recommendations. They've been releasing in pieces recommendations. There's a hard copy here in the room too, if anybody wants to look at it. As I kind of said in the email, it isn't supposedly the final text. They kind of traditionally kind of like, even once it's fully accepted and voted on by the council and the full membership, it's subject to some editorial changes, and there may have been some changes too at the meeting. But what they post online and they say is this can be cited as the official position of the ALI, subject to publishing the official text at some unknown date. The ALI on the publishing side of thing is, you know, it's a machine. So I don't know. It might be a year, and I don't know. So what we've sent is the best we've got, and it's a lot, right? It's nearly 700 pages. It's got a lot of research citations in it. It is on sentencing. A lot of it doesn't affect what we're doing. But it does in various respects, right? It talks about gradations. We mentioned it at some points in reference to the recidivist enhancement because they talk a fair bit about criminal history scores and how those could or should be used. Again, if you have any questions, let us know, but We're just kind of looking at that text too in the research, and we'll continue to cite it where we think that's relevant. Was there any more questions or concerns about that? So if not, we'll go ahead and get started. Do we have Michael at this point or?
He's been listening. Sorry.
He's on. Michael, are you on the phone?
Can you hear me? I'm on.
Great, yes, I can hear you now. Because of, we have you on, my cell phone speakerphone is our third backup here. What we can do, I wanted to start with the comments that we received on, goodness, this is the second draft of report number 2. Okay, so this is the discussion of kind of adding in with intent. And let me pull up the comments. And Michael, just so you know too, also on the phone we have Josh Turner standing in for Dave Rosenthal today from OAG. So if you want to start, go over those.
Yeah, so I really didn't have that much to add. I'd be happy to, in general, all OAG's comments are well taken. The first two have to do with whether a reference to either number should be replaced with, whether a reference currently to one conduct should be replaced with his or her. Generally speaking, it sounds good. It's something that's come up before. It would likely enhance the clarity of the current definitions of purpose, knowledge, and intent. The only thing that staff wanted to consider is, what extent when you're talking about the mens rea of complicity and conspiracy and solicitation, where they're multi-member offenses, and the culpability requirement incorporates mens rea as to the result caused by another person's conduct. To what extent the his or her would need to be qualified by for another person. So that's something that we're not at present ready to recommend. once we sort of develop our initial recommendations on the men's, on accomplice liability, conspiracy implication, we'll have a better sense. But just generally speaking, replacing the phrase of one's conduct with his or her, I think is well taken. Improvement. The OAG's second comment was similar, but it had to do with the with a similar replacement being made in the explanatory note. Same, say the same thing. And then the third and final recommendation OAG made had to do with adding a parallel example in a footnote, which was similar to an earlier example in a footnote to explanatory note. Provided for with knowledge to have a similar one with intent, and again, it's a recommendation well taken, staff will work on developing a footnote that runs parallel. So unless there's anything else that OAG would like to discuss, I'd just say all the recommendations are well taken, and that we'll be sure to incorporate them into the second draft.
Josh, did you have anything you wanted to add?
Well, I'd say that pretty well covers the scope of the comments we had there.
Great. Okay. Then let's move on to the OAG comments. If nobody else has anything on the second draft of report number 2, we'll move on to the OAG comments on report number 5 with offense classes and penalties. There were a few things. Thank you for Josh and Dave for sending these in. One of the first comments had to do with redrafting the language for how it's phrased in terms of a felony is more than 1 year or death. OAG suggested language we have up on the screen here that says it's just kind of a clearer format. Felony means any offense punishable A, by an authorized term of imprisonment that is more than 1 year, or B, by death in the case of a felony from a jurisdiction that permits capital punishment. Not a substantive change. I think it's a good one. Unless there's any concern, we'll go ahead and incorporate that. Second point that was raised in the OAG memo concerned, and this David mentioned this at the last meeting, parental kidnapping. He mentioned that parental kidnapping is defined as a felony, even though the maximum penalty is 1 year or less. They put the statute in their comments and suggested a change accordingly to kind of say that amend 22A 805 801A to say unless otherwise provided by statute, just a kind of a caveat for our definition of what a felony is. Similar language for felonies and misdemeanors, and an 801A. On that point, I would like to kind of suggest that two things. We've once or twice kind of gotten to this. There is general language right now in 103 and 104, 22A 103 and 104. Let me pull that up. So we already have general language in the, in the general provisions that kind of limit the extent of anything, including this new definition for misdemeanor or felony, to apply only to this new title, 22A. And we also, in 22A104 say the general provisions, again, apply to everything, including the other general provisions, if there's a definition. These two, I just want to kind of point this out because it's a recurring issue kind of for all of our general provisions that there might be specific exceptions in particular offenses, specific offenses later on. There might be And so, in a sense, we could start every general provision by saying, unless otherwise provided by law. But instead, what we've done is we have these general provisions that state broadly, this only applies here, and it doesn't apply outside. And we, in the commentary to that, also, you know, made very clear that this does allow for deviations in specific cases. Now,
even in 22A.
Even in 22A, yes. Now, one option would be to strengthen that. I guess my one concern I have about this particular OAG comment is, I think it's something we're going to see more often too. Again, on all the general provisions, you could always say unless otherwise provided by law. We could strengthen this to make it even clearer that that the special part may have deviations. But what I'd like to do is avoid in every single general provision saying this and try to have a broader statement. We've done it in the commentary. We have these two general provisions, and we've been relying on that to do the same work. So it's just a matter of how we codify it. So putting aside parental kidnapping as a specific example, this is a more general it's a drafting issue that we have. Do we want to, in each general provision, kind of start it out, unless otherwise provided by law, or do we want to have a general provision that kind of broadly states this only applies unless this is kind of essentially the default provision, unless a more specific instance or language is provided in a statute.
Can I ask a question using the specific?
Sure.
To ask a question about the general?
Please.
Why? I get, right, that a definition in 22A isn't automatically going to apply to parental kidnapping in Title 22. But if we were going to do something similar, right, if parental kidnapping is in 22A, is a misdemeanor, we're still going to call it a felony for other reasons, for the reasons it's currently called a felony, I think. Why couldn't we say in there, notwithstanding definition blah, 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 and here's my general question, and that is sort of strengthening that. I sort of feel like we're all going to be super thoughtful in piecing everything together and make real decisions about, when we want to mean something different, when we propose to depart. My worry about a sort of strengthening of whatever that is, I can't see that far, of this general, if you happen to be different, then mean that you're, you know, then we will interpret it to mean you're different, is the future when the council introduces something, not at all thinking it's in conflict, and that a strength in there will sort of say, well, so let's say something like parental kidnapping came up, and they just sort of use the word felony. Maybe that's a bad example, but they're not really thinking about the conflict. I don't know that I want something that automatically says resolve this as if they gave it some thought, or does it already work? Is that already how interpretation is going to work when the court gets it and says, wait, this specific, that they happen to use this language, there's no other reason to believe they meant to depart from this general except they didn't quite follow the way the general works, so let's read it as purposeful.
Sure. I mean, I would just say, like, I think, you know, the operation across most other revised codes is that the general provisions do operate by default, right? Like, that is the default. So silence on any exception in a specific offense would be then controlled by the statutory language that is generally applying to all offenses. So that's, you know, because I think part of your question is like, well, where's the default? How do we set the default? And what happens when there's legislative silence?
What happened? What would happen? Yeah. I don't know, smart people. What would happen if you took parental kidnapping exactly as it's written and you put it in 22A? And therefore, like, it could not make sense. You couldn't have 180 days and a felony and read it, and it wouldn't make sense. What would the court do? Would they say they must not have meant this definition? They don't really mean it. What would they do?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fair question, and I think, like, you know, certainly right now,
because right, that's not silence.
Yeah,
that's saying
no,
something, and everyone's
no,
like, but what is the? What,
that's
doesn't
right,
make sense.
And I think it's, you know, I think, you know, if the you know, statutory text isn't clear, they'd look to legislative history, and legislative history is going to show, like, a disconnect, hopefully, or again, silence, that there was no consideration of how this fits in with the supposedly control, you know, otherwise. And they are, you know, going to treat it as its kind of own thing superimposed on the system. And, you know, is that right or wrong? I don't know. It'd be interesting to see examples how other jurisdictions have done this, right? Because, like, again, we're following a model that's been done in, you know, dozens of other places. Now, again, a legislature gets lazy, sleepy. Something comes through that doesn't at all reflect the current general provisions. You know, they could have different mental states. They could have a different penalties. They could call it a felony, misdemeanor. They could make up some new name. They could do that. But again, what happens then in terms of conflict with the general provisions? Our basic rule is that if it is anything more specific, so in a specific offense, they're providing some what seems crazy new language that is in conflict with the general provisions, that's fine. That stands, unless you can, again, looking back at the legislative intent, you know, and other indicia of that in the legislative history, show that was somehow
they weren't trying.
Thought,
to be crazy.
Yeah, that even though the language says maliciously, and maliciously doesn't appear anymore, it's clear from legislative intent by maliciously, they thought that was identical to knowingly. You know, so they might be able to resolve it there, but no. I mean, you just kind of can't tie the hands of a future legislature to have a uniform practice. The best we can do is set up a model and kind of general rules and how to treat silence. But if it is something that is new and in conflict with, like, the general provisions, that would stand, I believe.
Well, I don't want to make that stronger.
Do not. Richard, I would just chime in to say that the rule of lenity. Right, so the way this would arise would be there'd be a particular issue, and the defense would have one position, the government would have another position on that issue, which would be relevant to whatever particular case is, and then if legislative intent is unclear, text is unclear, then the rule of lenity just, you know, basically directs the court to pick the more defendant-friendly outcome. So in a particular context, whatever the interpretive issue is, you know, it would seem like that's kind of a situation where the rule of lenity would play a meaningful role.
Yeah, I guess it might. You know, again, like, even our own rules of interpretation, which we're trying to model off of existing rules, right? You know, rule of lenity is at the end, and it may very well end up, I don't know, in the kind of, just depends on the facts of the situation, but yeah, I mean, look, this, hopefully we have a large enough shift that there won't be new offenses drafted or amendments that are in gross conflict with the general provisions. I think the more likely thing is going to be somebody drafts a new offense, you know, burning plants or, you know, bushes or shrubs or something, and doesn't think about some issue like causation, right? And has some language in there that, like, you know, it kind of seemed right when they put it together, but they weren't thinking about, like, oh, well, that, you know, that's normally not on the radar, right? And so, like, they didn't realize how that works with the general provisions over there. I suspect that's the more the kind of problem that might arise in the future. And, yeah, I have no... that if it's clear that they mean what, you know, and that's, again, it's going to be up to looking at the legislative intent, that they mean something different, then they're not bound by these general provisions in the end. So we can provide guides, and hopefully they will be followed, but Yeah. Well, let me say then one more thing, and then open it up again to any other comments on how to resolve this kind of general issue about whether we're kind of prefacing all general provisions unless otherwise provided in law, or strengthening something in the general provisions, which I hear Laura saying she's against, to kind of very bluntly say or flatly say, you know, deviations in specific offenses are controlling, right? Which is what we've said in the commentary, and I think this leaves open. The other thing I'd say on parental kidnapping is right. This, and there's one other thing a little bit further on, I think they're just not ripe yet, right? So we may end up having parental kidnapping as part of this revision. We may not get there, right? There are hundreds and hundreds of offenses buried in other titles. Parental kidnapping actually gets used. It's in Title 16, I think. But like, there is a ton of stuff out there that, you know, we're not going to get to in the foreseeable future. What happens with that? It stays in its own place. You know, whatever we're containing the effect of all these new recommendations to offenses that have been revised, okay? So it's not going to have any unintended spillover onto other things. So would it affect parental kidnapping? No, it shouldn't, would be the answer now. If at some point that gets, you know, revised, great. We have to, you know, elementize it. We have, you know, like kind of, we have to rethink that and the relationships. Yeah, I think on the particular issue of parental kidnapping, that it seems likely to me, we haven't looked at it, we haven't looked at how other jurisdictions do this or the history even to why our parental kidnapping ended up the way it did. I have no thoughts one way or the other on it now, but I'd kind of say, like, let's wait until we get there for parental kidnapping. On this general question, though, of whether to preface general provisions with this caveat language, any other thoughts on that, or, you know, concerns? All right. Well, if not, what we'll do is we'll check back. And Josh, I definitely appreciate your comment on this. And we'll check back again and see again whether there are tweaks that other jurisdictions have done in their general provisions to kind of clarify this and kind of, you know, again, how are they clarifying the resolution of a conflict between a specific offense and the general provisions in different jurisdictions? Are they doing it by statute, doing it commentary? Practically, how has this arisen? It'd be an interesting thing to kind of see. So we can look into that. Some of the other comments from OAG, one was that on fines, let me pull their comments back up here. Let's see, here we go. Right, there was some suggested language change saying the phrase "not more than" is redundant in some of the listing of imprisonment penalties and for fines. Totally agree. We can get rid of that. There was reference again that we should correct the reference to the Supreme Court limitation is on if it's more than 6 months. Is when it's considered to be jury demandable, and so we'll correct that. We talked about it last time, but that's definitely correct. It should be more than 6 months. OAG then kind of this was on page 3 of their comments, had suggested some language changes, clarificatory, non-substantive, to how the fines were penalties were referenced. And on that point, I would just say, like, I agree this can be cleaned up. The language that was suggested, I've got it up on the screen now. It's definitely better. I think we may be able to do better still if we kind of spend some time on this. So non-substantive change, but I will follow up maybe with Josh or Dave on like seeing if we can kind of clean this language up, make it a bit tighter. And their concern was just that in the current language, we have this kind of phrase tacked on the end, the pecuniary loss or gain must be alleged in the indictment and proved beyond reasonable doubt. I take it OAG's main point here was like, that is true when you are going by one of these alternative means of calculating the fine. But for an ordinary fine, you don't have to each time allege pecuniary loss or gain in the indictment. And we didn't mean that either. So I took that as a kind of a friendly improvement to the drafting that OIG had suggested, and I agree with the thrust of it. And so I'll follow up to whether we can, maybe we can do even better still on the drafting of it. But it's non-substantive. Is that a fair characterization, Josh? Josh, do we still have you on the phone? Oh boy! All right. Well, maybe we've lost Josh, or
it might have run out of
power.
Because of course it did.
I wouldn't think so. But.
Oh my God! That's everybody.
No, nobody's called back. That's Michael.
Yeah,
sorry.
Sure you call me.
Take a short minute here. See if we can sort this out. Hello.
This is a decent government agency. Just teasing.
No. Interesting. No, nobody touched the phone, so I don't know why that cut out. Do you want to call in and try it again? Okay. Let me try to call into the main line again and see if I can pick them up. So we'll call you to circle back on. Thanks. All right. Apologies. Apparently some point, actually after Josh last spoke, somehow then they could continue to hear each other and talk with each other online, but then we were cut out from them and there was some problem. So we'll try this again. Again, apologies. Let me check again, see if she's out there. Hello?
That means we could have brought alcohol to this meeting.
You have to enter some.
No, it's not giving me anything right now.
Damn. This was our chance. There's no home. We could have had alcohol.
Hello, this is Richard. Paul, are you there? Great, and Josh, are you there too?
I am.
Excellent, okay. Great, good. Sorry we lost you all there. We just don't even know what happened. The phone wasn't touched, but it sounds like we lost connection with you. Well, let me maybe just summarize the last little bit, and then if there's anything you want to interject, we're just again on this question of how to handle parental kidnapping in particular, but this more general question, and I think that's where they got cut. I'm sorry. So was there anything more you guys had on that? I think that was probably the last thing you had probably heard before you got cut off.
The only thought that I had there was just sort of echoing the notwithstanding point from a few minutes before about how that can be a really effective way
to specifically identify intentional departures from a more general rule as kind of and as a way that's easier a lot of the time than trying to have a except where otherwise specified caveat for every general rule that's out there.
Yeah, great. Good. Well, I think we're left as we'll look into a bit more any other best practices on this around other jurisdictions, and we'll follow up. It's definitely a valid concern that we want to be as clear as we can. We had actually, because we didn't realize we'd lost you all, unfortunately. We started to move forward quickly. Couple more things. OAG's recommendation to get rid of the not more than language as redundant, great, on board with that. Clarifying that it's more than 6 months for the Supreme Court requirements, great, we'll correct that. And then we're just saying on the alternative maximum fines, the language, definitely agree with the thrust of OAG's comments, which was that we want to be clear there's no requirement to prove this kind of language about pecuniary loss or gain in the ordinary case where somebody is following the main default maxima for fines. It's just in the special case where somebody's relying on these alternatives, that's when it needs to be proven. So definitely agree with that.
Yeah.
The drafting that, Josh, your office put together is definitely good. I think we may be able to, looking at it, had some ideas on how to maybe draft it even better, so we'll follow up with you and Dave and then recirculate it, but I think it's a non-substantive change either way. It's just drafting it to kind of make it as clear as possible. The last thing, I guess, two more things. OAG had suggested that right now we have this alternative fine for organizational defendants for anybody accused. Right now it's a 1 year misdemeanor, or 6 months, I believe, or more. And we had pitched that as being kind of translated in our recommendations as applying to Class A misdemeanors or 1 year or greater misdemeanors. Then organizational defendants would be subject to this doubling of fines. And the recommendation from OAG was, hey, why do we have that cutoff? Shouldn't this just be across the board for any misdemeanor offense? An organizational defendant would be subject to doubling fine. The one thing I wanted to add on this and kind of raise with folks was I don't know that this would be an issue, but it could be that, this the line on jury demandability. Your comments prompted me to go back and actually, look at the Blanton case. Laura's primed on this one.
I was fooling around until you said jury demandability.
Oh, good.
Go ahead. I'm
jury demandability. Now she's on. This is the magic words I need to get Laura's attention. Good. The Blanton Supreme Court opinion really said that what constitutes a misdemeanor or a petty misdemeanor that avoids jury demandability, it isn't a hard and fast rule that it's under 6 months, but that under 6 months is essentially a default rule. And one of the things they want is they go out of their way to say is, look, if there are other indicia of punishment besides incarceration, and they specifically go to fines and look at fines, there it was a $1,000 fine. They said, $1,000, it's well below, they say, the $5,000 level set by Congress in defining a petty offense that's not jury demandable. So they didn't find objection to it. But it is the kind of thing which, if we start to provide, double penalties, or I believe Dave might have mentioned the last meeting orally, well, what about quadruple penalties? there's a point at which for these, and then the question is for these misdemeanors, for low-level misdemeanors, to the extent that low-level misdemeanors are starting to trigger substantial fines in the thousands of dollars, we may start to flirt with this line in Blanton that Blanton suggests is there about having severe enough non-incarcerative penalties that it raises the offense to one that is jury demandable. So again, I don't know that the OAG recommendation with respect to doubling fines all the way down for even the lowest level misdemeanors would make the fines so severe that by under constitutional law they would then be jury demandable. I'm not aware of any hard lines or bright lines out there on this, but it is the kind of argument that begins to come into play when we have these lower level 180 day less currently non-jury demandable misdemeanors being subject to higher fines. Does that make sense? The issue that's out there. Again, otherwise, I don't have any objection to this, but I just wanted to raise that as a concern that raising the fines for these low-level misdemeanors could potentially begin to run into this other issue of jury demandability that it's relevant to everybody's concerns. So thoughts on that? Josh, I don't know if you guys had considered that or if that's something you just want to chew on a little bit more and think about or...
Yeah, well, I can go ahead and forward the comments to Dave so that we can kind of discuss a little bit further when he gets back.
Sure.
It's definitely something we'll be happy to... a kind of line of thought that we'll be happy to take a look at and mull over.
Great. Good. Okay. Well, we'll kind of leave that for now then. With that kind of caveat sitting out there, and the last issue in the OAG comments. Let's see. I guess it's related to that doubling of penalties. Let's see. Right. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. So this, I've got it up on the screen now. The point was, again, so there are certain offenses which right now under the Fine Proportionality Act are exempted, right? They don't follow any, the kind of standard pattern we have now for fines. Generally, white collar type offenses that were deviations under the Fine Proportionality Act. Not all. There were. Some of you probably know better than I how those came about. Regardless, we have these deviations, and I take it where OAG was going with this was to say, again, what we want to do is where we're doubling for organizational defendants the fine. We're not doubling the standard. Necessarily, because some of these offenses, I think OAG is expecting, will have their own kind of non-standard fines applied, in which case, in our general provision, we should make sure that accommodates up front the fact that we're going to have, or expect to have, some non-standard fines that don't follow the schedule, like we do now in the Fine Proportionality Act. Is that a fair summary, Josh?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I think it's totally it's an excellent point. I don't know that we're there yet in the sense it's kind of fully ripe yet because I never went through kind of to know or evaluate kind of why there were those deviations from the Fine Proportionality Act when we had them before. might make perfect sense, but until we kind of get to a place where we know there's an exception from the standard schedule, is maybe a bit putting the cart before the horse, but I think it's an absolutely right point. If we do have deviations from the standard schedule for fines, then we would probably want to adjust it here as well. Again, those Blanton-type concerns about low-level misdemeanors having their fines at such a high level that it bumps them into being jury demandable, that stays out there, and this might even kind of aggravate it in some cases if there was a low-level misdemeanor with an unusual non-standard fine. This would, again, kind of potentially aggravate it even more by doubling even that non-standard fine, assuming it was higher. So, yeah, something to be aware of, and maybe if you know, talk again with Dave on kind of this jury demandability issue, reflect on that. But I'd also just say, like, I think this is a good recommendation, but it may be something that we don't have to encounter yet until we start having these exceptions to the standard fine schedule. Does that make sense? Any questions on that or other concerns? All right. Good. Well, and Josh, anything else you wanted to add in for OAG comments?
Not at this point, no.
Great.
I think that pretty much covers the waterfront.
All right. Good. Well, then we get to the PDS comments, which were, you know, awesome. Open up new vistas. yes. So, turning to the PDS comments, let me pull those up on the screen. So, you know, there were a number of general points that were raised, and I want to hold on to those maybe just for a minute and turn to the last point first in the PDS, because it was very kind of a specific point about how to kind of characterize this, the kind of default of jury demandability or not, right? And the recommendation in PDS comments was that, look, and sorry if I'm wrong, but, you know, say it's fine to have to get rid of the 180-day, 6-month distinction and have a default rule or just one default, 180 days. But if you do that, then what you should be doing is the default 180-day should all be jury demandable unless you put in an exception to say it's not. In other words, what they would have is fine, we merge 6 month and 180 days, but the default for the new rule is that it is jury demandable, and each time it's not, you have to say it's not. Instead of the flip, the reverse, which is kind of what we put in the initial recommendations, which was it all goes to 180 days. By default, 180 days is not jury demandable unless you say in a specific offense it is. Now, so the question is really, where's the default and how? When do you say which is which? Now, I would say substantively, for our recommendations, you know, they come out to the same place, which is to say, we're going to have to think through for all the work we do, we will specify it, right? So, like, one way or the other. So, in some sense, I take it this is kind of a process point, not even so much for us and a drafting point. Partly, it would have certainly affect how we write up ours, but it's also a point for the future. And I think this is part of the PDS comments was how for future legislative action, if they just say 180 days and are silent, again, kind of like what's the default? Or do you require in future legislation to accept that offense and say this is not going to be jury demandable. And is that a fair characterization, Laura? I'm just trying to summarize. Or what would you like to add? What would clarify? Yes.
Yeah, no, that's it. You got it.
Okay. So I wanted to open that up for comments. I think, again, as a code revision matter, our biggest concern in making this was to get rid of what I think to anybody who's not kind of a criminal practitioner in the district, the 6-month, 180-day distinction, and to make it clear and have clear rules about when it is and is not jury demandable. Which was the default in, which is the default out. Right now, I would say the current statute, and again, it's tucked away somewhere else. It was Title 16, right? The way the current Title 16 statute is written is it basically says where it's not constitutionally compelled, first of all, so wherever that line is, and per Blanton, it may be a little bit movable, but generally it's at the more than 6 month. But we're under that constitutional requirement. We're going to say everything is by judge. It is not jury demandable unless the defendant wants a jury, two, it's 180 days or less. So that's the way the current statute's set up in Title 16. So right now we've got the default on the saying not jury demandable, except in these certain circumstances.
And so it should come as no surprise to you, given our position from the beginning, that we are starting from current law, as indicated either statutorily or through D.C. Court of Appeals decision. That's where we would start with the default. And it's also simply customary. It's practice. I mean, I screened yesterday for the first time in ages, so if anybody heard that all the sex offense and domestic violence cases made it into the courtroom late, it was all my fault. But, I mean, you know, for example, if you're practicing here, that threats is a jury demandable offense, in that we have that, therefore, fiction of attempted threats in this jurisdiction. I mean, it's just how we operate, that the default of 180 days or less is bench trial, and that anything over that or specified is jury demandable, or if you have a combination of non-jury demandable cases, I think it's 6 or more, then it becomes jury demandable. And I think that ought to be the starting place.
Except that the classification reflects a choice of picking 180 days compared to picking 6 months. There's no reason the classification couldn't have been 6 months. And then we'd be talking about a default jury trial. And then the only question would be whether you'd be allowed to, in certain circumstances, say no jury trial here. So you know, whether the line is 6 months or more than 6 months, I thought, well, I'm not going to fight over that. We can stop fighting over the line between 180 days and 6 months. But it is a choice that got made. There's nothing inherent about let's pick 180 days as that particular classification. They could have just as well picked 6 months, and then we'd be having the exact opposite conversation. They are two separately moving things. So fine, pick 180 days. So that at least there's a choice one way or the other, and that's clear under Supreme Court law, I think. I don't know, I haven't read these cases. But we ought to be making a decision each time, and we ought to start with jury trials. We ought to start with jury trials. And where people think that people don't deserve jury trials, well, then we ought to say it. But we know, because we've done this all the time, you know, they never understand why we fight over 180 days and 6 months. They don't. And it shouldn't be hidden. People should know. People think you get jury trials because, I don't know, it's in the Constitution. So if you're not going to, then you ought to be up front in a statute and say, you know, this isn't one of those ones we think you should get a jury on. And that's what we're saying. That when we're right on that line, put it up there. And the council should have to say every time they're making that decision, when they want to deprive somebody of a jury, they ought to have to say it publicly as opposed to hiding it under just calling it 180 days.
I don't think we would have an objection to that. The council should, and you're right. We have seen it over and over and over again. The only time we may not have seen it was when they were clear in their purpose in connection with assault on police officers and resisting arrest. That was the one time when they're seen. I'm sorry?
Yes, hello.
Is anybody there?
Yes.
Josh, can you hear us?
I lost you for about 4 or 5 seconds.
Okay. Good. And Paul, do we have you still on?
Yeah, I'm here.
Great. Okay, and Michael also?
We had leftover fireworks from the 4th of July, and we're setting them up right now.
I'm still here.
Okay, great. Okay, good. We got everybody just some, good. Turn it back
this
to Renata here. Sorry about this.
Terribly unsatisfying because when Laura and I are on, we're gone. And you seem to be catching us when we're sleeping. So.
Fair enough.
So I think that I was saying that you're right.
That's what I thought you were saying.
On a very limited point. Hope we didn't lose you there. This, just like our first issue that we discussed, is laying bare, and it's interesting. I don't think Chanel is on. But a concern about our legislators and whether, in fact, we believe that they always act with the intent and thoughtfulness that people expect legislators to, and frankly, whether all legislative proposals start with the council. You know, they can come from any stakeholder, so we can't depend on that. But with respect to this issue, at least, I think that we would agree. We got to pick. And our position would be that to the extent that we're classifying things as jury demandable or not, we start with where we are today as far as we understand what is and isn't jury demandable. And you're right, it's going to be interesting going forward. Perhaps not as clear and predictable as we think this approach ought to make it as to where those things come out from time to time. And Laura and I won't always be around or catch you to say, hey, what the heck are you talking about here? And to make those points.
Would anybody else like to chime in on this point?
This is not the end of this debate, right?
I'll just agree with Laura about the need for transparency here and the presumption in favor of Trishwell. No, this is Paul.
All right. Thank you. Anyone else? All right. Well,
I agree with Laura and agree with Renata, not just me.
Right, well, yeah, because I think I was agreeing on the point of transparency.
A lot of agreement. This is wonderful. Transparency, yes. Maybe some disagreement again on where the default is. And frankly, I don't know that we're going to get everybody on the same page with that, right? So we will, one thing we can look at again is where other jurisdictions are on this point. You know, frankly, again, one thing we've often looked at where we hit some hard issues, we just kind of see, what are the norms out there? Is the district that doesn't going to determine it though? Frankly, this is an issue that what I hear actually Renata also saying too is in some sense the bigger issue here is making sure that the council in future lawmaking. Is aware of kind of fully cognizant of the consequences of and what it's the set draft, any drafts, any bills that are coming forward, what those implications are. So I think actually this is something I should talk, really would be good to hear from Chanel on, and get a sense from that side too. So we're not going to be acting on this immediately, and we'll try to do a little bit more, maybe raise it even at the September meeting when hopefully Chanel will be back to kind of see if this is an issue they have strong feelings about either. Because it, I think it is primarily one for the future council and for the operation going forward. Regardless, we're going to have to do this on each time, right? We, you know, on drawing these lines. So we will do that. Setting up this rule, though, will affect in the future. Let me, if there's nothing else, turn to some of the other PDS comments, and you know, like, look, if everybody had a chance to review them, you know, there's a lot of kind of general, you know, there's the kind of the starting point was to say a kind of a general disagreement with aligning the new felony classes with even the kind of existing de facto practice or statutes, right? And I take that to mean, and you know, pointing to you know other authorities, and look, the ALI recommendations is you know are very different than where the district is currently, and I think this is a very real point. One thing I wanted to really open up for the group, I think we're going to have obviously a lot of disagreement on the absolute numbers we attach for specific offenses, even at the very top for you know some kind of aggravated first degree murder, or at the bottom for the lowest level felony. We might even disagree what you know that constitutes. At this stage of the game, what I think is very important, though, is to get a general sense of where these lines are and the number of boxes out there. And if you haven't had this opportunity yet, you know, well, you'll see very soon when we come out with the property offenses, kind of how this starts to become important, right? If we're moving from two grades of theft to more, to three, to four, to 10, or if we're moving from the current one degree of kidnapping, which is, you know, it's aberrant, right? Like, the district is very unusual in the very few gradations it has for a lot of offenses. So if we're increasing the gradations of offenses, well, one, fine, we need to have a conversation to figure out where are the dividing lines between these gradations. But secondly, as soon as you start to grade them differently, well, then, of course, they have to have different penalties. And the number of options that you have really affects things. If you only have, you know, four boxes out there for new classes, and you've got four degrees of theft, what do you do with that? That's kind of ridiculous, right? Like, you have to have enough differentiation in these class levels. Again, put aside the absolute number. Whether the absolute number, the top number is life without parole or 60 years or 100 years, whatever that is, in some sense, the most important number here is how many classes that you have. Right, and I think as we begin to look at with property offenses coming up soon, you know how many gradations there are and how they fit in, knowing that we have put up on the screen, you know, these eight felony classes, whatever their top numbers and bottom numbers may be, and misdemeanor classes, does that make sense? Because again, I think we're going to have moving pieces and hopefully negotiations. Hopefully we can come together more or less, although we might have a couple of different options on final penalty recommendations, if we have fundamental disagreement at this point on how many options there are, right? If somebody thinks, for instance, that there should only be 4 felony classes or that there should be significantly more, we kind of need to figure that out now, because again, it will play into how many gradations. The best example I can just say is, again, it's like, you know, something like theft, right? Theft in most jurisdictions and in ours is graded by value, right? We have the magic $1,000 cutoff. $1,000 or more, 10 years, under that, 180 days. A very kind of sharp line drawn there. We draw out more gradations of theft. Where do those go? And you want to be able to have enough different classes to handle that in the range without it becoming, for instance, you know, all misdemeanors or, you know, all equivalent at the top. You just want to have enough. There's also danger of having too many classes because, if we have one for every 3-year increment, you know, 3, 6, 9, 12, 15, on up, we lose the virtues of the classification system, which is having a go-to way, particularly for the legislature in the future also, to say, here's a group that is of approximately the same seriousness, and we can treat them together as an offense, and we want to apply an enhancement. We can do that for this group of offenses. Things just get very unruly, and you lose the coherence of the whole system if you have too many classes. So, as PDS was the only one to address this, I want to kind of raise that question, which is, in some sense, a very basic one, which is this going to be adequate for the numbers of classes? Okay, so like, if you don't think about, you know, what's at the top, or is a class 1 felony subject to a life without parole? Is it 60 years? Is it 30 years? Is it 20 years? Does this seem like a reasonable number for people to work with in terms of differentiating but not becoming too granular? Just general reasonableness. I'm kind of, you know, because if we have problems with that, we can talk about it more, but we really need to know going into looking at some of these gradations. Yeah. Thoughts or questions or... All right.
We think it's too many classes.
Too many classes.
I mean, you can't... We think the numbers need to come down. You can't bring the numbers down and not end up with a difference between the classifications being 2 years or 3 years. And the numbers should come down. I also think, you know, I'm not all deep in property offenses, for which I am grateful. But I do remember when we talked about burglary... Mm-hmm. Years ago, and thinking about all the ways we were trying to sort of figure out sort of burglary, and I feel like we've talked about this with respect to sex offenses as well, right? But that you could have lots of different moving parts to burglary doesn't mean they all have to be punished differently, right? So you could have home at night as the absolute top, but business, you know. You could have more than one thing, but business at night is maybe the same as home during the day. And even though you want those different time and place and whether somebody's home or they're not, doesn't mean you have to have a million classifications to accommodate all those things that we say, well, we do want to treat this a little differently. We think the numbers should come... I mean, yeah, that's too many. You have to fill those with something. So anyway, that's our position. We wrote this comment, so...
Other thoughts?
Yeah. I also just know that we have very broad ranges associated with these, with this, what appears to be a very finely graded set of offenses, right? And so it is illusory because the ranges associated with each tend to be so broad, which I think is consistent with Laura's point that each of the existing categories allows for very high penalties. I would really, and I know that I'm partially responsible for not having this, but I would really like to be able to see the range of penalties imposed for each of these offenses across the different criminal history scores. Sure.
So on the kind of empirical, where are things now? You know, the memo that we put out with this, let's see, it was 10, although, you know, with Bryson's help in particular, put together some charts that kind of, oops, sorry, this is on enhancement, sorry. It's not what I want. You know, Bryson looked at some of it again, kind of like the distributions for what's going on now, just by statutory maxima. And I think, you know, this is a real, you know, concern coming from PDS, is that we don't want it modeled on current statute, but here's, you know, basically where it is now. So you see these blips right now at 2 years, 3, 5, then you get 10, 15, 20, 30, life. There's some stuff scattered in, and one thing that this misses, because this is statutory penalties, you know, that are on the books, this doesn't go to what's being imposed. And it doesn't include the very, very important while armed enhancement, right? Which functionally raises a number of offenses, right, up significantly. So, you know, how reality plays against this, this is one step, though, looking at the statutory maxes that are out there are similar to what we were pitching, right?
Where is that in our materials?
Sure. This is the memo number 9 that went out with, so advisory group memo number 9, page 4.
Is it possible for you to send just that page?
Possible. Like right now? I can try.
Sorry, what page is it?
I believe page 4.
Okay.
Let's see if it'll paste into my online interface. Well, that's not going to work.
Can I?
Yes.
Ask. I know we're in the middle of this, but I think the comments on the other stuff is going to be due on the 21st, no matter what happens at today's meeting. Is there any way we could?
Yes. Move on to that. Sure.
Some of us are going to turn into pumpkins.
You bet. Okay. Let me just send this actually just out here quickly I'm sorry.
If your internet's actually. Not actually connecting right now.
Great. Yeah, we've.
Yours also has a. Yeah.
We're, yeah, having some building wide issues with the Wi Fi. So, let me just send this. For those who aren't in the rooms, I'll try to send it out. Again.
Thanks, Richard.
I'm not sure our connectivity is going to do it. I guess I would just say is to open it up to anybody else who wanted to kind of respond to the PDS comments generally, which, again, the larger focus was bringing down penalty, the maxima, and with that, it sounds like then also there's too many classes because if you have these at the top, they're going to get filled at the top. We need to bring it down. This is a general point. would also appreciate if, you know, if you know, USAO, if anybody going forward has additional comments. One thing we had looked at for the very top was, you know, given, you know, BOP policy and, you know, what good time means, we have limited availability as to alternatives for handling very severe sentences, right? A life sentence is a life without parole sentence, since we don't have parole anymore, right? One option that, you know, we mentioned in the memo that we looked at was, again, you know, what was put out there recently for the Comprehensive Youth Justice Act, the kind of, you know, juveniles, there's some different permutations, but I think 15 or 20 years later, you can petition the court, right, for review. There may be some sort of more innovative, creative mechanism that could be instituted to handle the most severe sentences that would involve such a look back, some sort of court review at a later date. But otherwise, I just want to put that out there, because this is, it's a very difficult, you know, we're very constrained in what we can do for these very long sentences that are approaching life. The district's hands, I think, are tied in a way that other jurisdictions aren't. And so, again, is there some different procedural alternative? If there's other ideas on this, you know, some creative ideas, I would solicit those. I'd also like to actively solicit, again, if there are gradations that are missing. Okay, so Laura kind of said, you know, we've got a lot, got too many. You know, if the distribution needs to switch, and I will say, you know, at the bottom end, right? Like, if PDS is be interested in, like, you know, some very some jurisdictions have very short term, you know, the a night in prison, right? You know, a week. At the bottom felony end, you know, a year and a day. I've seen draft legislation being pitched by some folks that would change, you know, some statutes on the felony misdemeanor kind of line because it has different immigration consequences, right? There are lots of ways in which the where these classes are set at the bottom ends could also be influential. If you have thoughts on that, preferences, let me know. But okay, so it looks like maybe that, since I'm getting that email out, it's, something might have gone through, hopefully. So unless there are other comments, though, right now on PDS, it sounds like PDS themselves would like to move forward to some of the other materials that were out there on attempt and the penalty enhancements. So unless other folks want to talk about... No. All right.
Hey, Richard.
Yes.
Richard, real quick. I just wanted to chime in with one quick comment, which is to say that the overall severity and the number of gradations, I think are things like two issues that are easily separated. So, for example, in Germany, the highest penalty is around 20 years for any offense. I was just taking a quick look at, you know, the way they break things down. I mean, they have four different degrees of sex assault, multiple degrees of theft, which is to say, and that's all working in within a 20-year top end. It seems like they make, you know, possibly many more gradations above eight in the felony range, and which is so interesting to say that it is possible to have a top end that is quite low, but still recognize a number of distinctions, and, you know, and vice versa, and that, at least to some extent, they're probably issues worth considering separately.
Fair enough. Good. Well, it sounds like, why don't we move on then? And was it particularly more on attempt or
can
on?
Can we talk about attempt, yes.
Okay. Great. Well, let's then turn to, so what is floated out there again, comments due here, let's see, it's the 21st, on attempt and penalty enhancements. On attempt, open up for questions and first go to Laura if yeah, PDS has issues.
We had a few questions.
Yeah.
One, we on hybrid impossibility, we wanted to know sort of DC case law on it as a concept. It seemed that the sort of couple of cases there were on issues where there's a statutory sort of provision allowing for a conviction, even though it was technically impossible, right? So enticing a child who's actually an FBI agent or something. But the decision to treat hybrid impossibility the way that's proposed, where is the DC case law in support of that?
Yeah, so I believe it was primarily the In Re Doe case, where, you know, I think the procedural posture of the case is a little bit funky because it has to do with a comparison of a federal offense and a DC offense, but the court's overall general analysis seems pretty clear in terms of, you know, let me see if I can just pull up the language. You know, come along the lines of whether or not the victim is actually underage or like a law enforcement agent, the person's dangerousness and intent and criminal intent are all the same. So yeah, that case seemed like a pretty clear statement in terms of where district law is that, but you know, is that alongside the fact that it seems like that's pretty much where national legal trends strongly point. As it's also very hard to draw the line in the first, like, I mean, so I guess the question would be, like, the alternative would be to say what? To say that, I'd ask that as a question. What would be the alternative approach?
The alternative approach would be that hybrid impossibility is, under the attempt statute, isn't a crime.
Okay.
But that in specific instances, say enticing a child, that it could be written into the statute, that where people sort of felt the truthfulness of the legal status shouldn't matter to whether we're going to hold somebody culpable, that could be written in, but I guess it concerns. Well, to preview, it concerns us to punish people for thought crimes when it can't actually be done, and in the end, no matter what actions they take, the real thing can't happen, and so we're punishing them for bad intentions. But where those bad intentions are dangerous enough, then that could be specifically written in.
So it seems like that line of analysis would equally support abolishing factual possibility as well. I mean, where someone is planning, to blow up a building, but the dynamite is fully inoperative. That you can say the exact same thing about that situation, which is to say there's no possibility of I'm still sleepwalking on because the explosive device wasn't operative. And so I think the modern trend toward getting rid of hybrid responsibility is just that whatever the policy is on back responsibility is equally applicable to hybrid responsibility, because in both situations it's just the case that it could never happen. I mean, you know, you could also envision, let's say, a less extreme hypothetical for hybrid responsibility, where the where you have like a let's say an undercover officer, but simply where the person believes that the person on the other end was underage, but the only difference is between let's say whatever the age of legal consent or the requisite ages for the sex offense, it's two year difference. In that case, the difference is quite slight. And, at the same time, I mean, to say that impossibility as a whole, any sort of impossibility should be rejected here, or should be accepted as a viable basis for an attempt in particular. I think that's a legitimate position. I'm not sure if it's anyone that is, that's applied in any jurisdiction in America. I mean, so the thought here was, to have that reasonable adaptation or extreme possibility limitation kind of provides a buffer where, when it gets to a certain level or a certain extent of impossibility that it just kind of shocks the conscience. It's wholly unintuitive to hold someone liable. Like, there is that route, and that argument would remain viable. But that aside, it seems like the reasoning that supports rejecting the possibility of defense is equally applicable to hybrid and factual. And I did that lastly as a matter of practice. I think courts have just had a really hard time making the distinctions between the two in any event. And so between the policy and the practical concern, I think that's kind of what motivated the general trend to abolish the two together.
When you say the modern trend, that's looking at sort of statutes for reform jurisdictions, or that's like Lefebvre treatise stuff?
Both. I mean, we didn't do a in-depth 50 state survey, but we certainly went through a lot of cases, and then we rely on, when there are legal commentaries, whether it's Lefebvre or Dressler, and states themselves will make references to particular trends, incorporate those as well. So, based upon a combination of looking at treatises and, statutes on our own, and in some cases, that is what appears to be the case. If we overlooked or missed something, that would, certainly be something we would be happy to see.
Okay. And with respect to the proposal, what you wrote, do you think that it pretty much tracks, maybe not the word I want, but reflects how the Red Book explains district law and attempt? I'm thinking in particular about the did an act reasonably adapted to accomplishing the crime, which is in the Red Book, but is the way that you've written the proposal, you only get to that if you're, well, in the section where you're sort of trying to figure out the impossibility thing.
Yeah, so that, it's a really good question. The reasonable adaptation piece presented a very interesting case for what we were doing. And so, I just say as a general matter, the focus was to do our best to translate and clarify district law on the issue. As you know, the memo lays out, there's so many sort of fundamental conflicting policy issues here. You know, the general mindset was, you know, does the district have an approach that seems, you know, clear or well established? And if so, we'll kind of go with it. Unless there were strong reasons to the contrary. With the legal adaptation, though, was interesting because it's not really clear at all from either the Red Book or DC case law what precisely it's doing. And so to try and understand a little bit better, we looked to various common law authorities from which district law appears to be based. So the dangerous proximity test is based upon a test developed by Oliver Wendell Holmes and the Red Book, which is at least the second edition of the Red Book cites to. And so, looking at those common law authorities, it became clearer as to what reasonable adaptation means in those jurisdictions that have clarified it, and sort of as a matter, as a historical matter. And so what we did was try and present that here. And, hopefully the memo was clear on that point, which is to say that, where reasonably adapted is placed is a interpretive reconstruction of an issue that D.C. law, whether regulatory instructions or case law, is not particularly clear on. Sorry, did that answer your question for?
Well, I'm not really sure. So here's what I think I heard you say. So that in case law, Red Book aside, and the brilliance of the people that work on Red Book aside, but that case law talks about reasonably adapted more in the context of these impossibility things. Rather than in general discussions of attempt, is that what you're saying? That it doesn't, that Red Book kind of puts it in there, but their case law doesn't support that it's a piece of
here's what I'd say, that first, DC law generally is not provides federal guidance. The guidance that is provided is the few cases where reasonably adapted is discussed. Happens to be impossibility cases, typically, some cases, I think, in the United States where the government's theory is that the person need not know that it's drugs as long as they believe that it's drugs. So looking at other common law authorities, which is to say, other cases from other jurisdictions, other law review articles, other legal treatise sections, this is what reasonably adapted seems to mean, and that does gel with the very limited, sparse mention and pattern of usage in DC case law, but that for the most part this is a gap filler. I don't think it's inconsistent with DC law, and it's doing the best to try and make sense of it. Is there an alternative proposal or something different that a different approach or a different use of the phrase recently adapted that you have in mind?
Well, I was trying to understand it. It was more that, quite frankly, the way we were reading the proposal is it is less than the current Red Book. If you engage in conduct planned to culminate in the offense and you got the mental state and blah 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 and you come dangerously close, you've left out what's currently in the Red Book, which is that your conduct has to be reasonably adapted to the commission of that offense. So the question was, is it left out?
Right, right.
Is it somehow subsumed into dangerously close, I don't think so, or somehow subsumed into plans to culminate in that offense. Again, I didn't really think so. So that was sort of, maybe I should have asked a better question in the first place, but I guess that was sort of it. Is it gone, or is it? Does it turn out to get read into one of those others? It seems no, because you've actually specified it in this 3B. That was sort of what the question was.
Perfect. Now I understand. Yeah, it's a very good point. So here's what I'd say, that in any situation, well, so first of all, for speed under 3A and for dangerously close without the language in the situation that the person perceived it, is a much higher burden, generally speaking, for the government. Because it requires a more objective view of the situation. I think the general thought was that any time in which the government would elect to proceed under a pure dangerously close analysis without the impossibility actor-specific language incorporated into the formulation, that those would not ever be cases where reasonably adapted was ever even potentially at issue. Because the reasonably adapted situation, is like the sort of heartland, at least, of them is trying to kill by voodoo, or trying to commit a murder with Tylenol, let's say.
Actually.
So in that situation, in those kinds of cases, the facts are so egregious that a pure 3A instruction of just dangerously close, like, it would be really easy to answer that in the negative.
Okay. I hear what you're saying. We're going to think about that. But I have another question.
Sorry, the last thing.
No.
I just say one last thing on that, Laura, which is that it is very much a viable 3A is, in a sense, kind of superfluous. The reason it was kept in there, what we had in mind was a matter of basically allowing for clear jury instruction. So in the sort of standard, like, frustrated attempt situation where the police stop the bank robber, let's say a block away from the bank, in that situation, you wouldn't want to necessarily muddy the jury's instructions with the sort of situation-specific language, because it's pretty clear in that, what's at stake there. But certainly something we considered as something that would be, possibility just to delete 3A, period.
Well, no.
And not have it either.
Okay, yeah, no, I didn't. We no. Okay, so perhaps my final question on this, and I thank everyone for giving me this time. So this is hard. At least it was hard for me to sort of read and get my head around and stuff. There were a few sort of footnotes, and I think, for me anyway, thinking about this, where it got hard, quite frankly, is where the code's already fudging on stuff, these assaults. So I'll just sort of do the footnotes. In the end, this may just be a non-substantive suggestion. This may just be that your examples need to be better. So starting, for example, with footnote number 2, this was, you were explaining about the planning requirement and the importance of that sort of language. And you say, for example, to determine whether a person arrested by the police just prior to pulling a firearm out of his waistband acted with the intent to kill a nearby victim entails the determination that the person planned to retrieve the firearm, aim it at the victim, and pull the trigger. So it concerns us that this would seem to imply that those particular conduct descriptions somehow would be some offense that proves intent to kill, as opposed to, anything else, shoot in the air. I mean, so it's that kind of sort of overstatement. It happens again in footnote 8, where the person attempted felony assault where the person suffers a debilitating heart attack, just as, I didn't even get who was having the heart attack. But in any case, somebody has a heart attack. They were about to exit the vehicle and repeatedly beat the intended victim, which when I was sort of trying to understand it, I don't really know, and I don't how you're going to, how attempt is going to work with gradations of injury, gradations of results, when it hasn't happened. And this really kind of, how is that an attempted felony assault? I didn't beat you yet. We don't know what was going to happen. I was just going to give you one good punch. Same thing with attempted murder in footnote 11. Again, that just maybe choose a different offense, but it sort of implies the conduct, shooting the gun that's empty. Well, if I was aiming at your ankle, probably not. If I held it up to your temple, okay, maybe. So it's those, it's more, so some of this is a non-substantive. It worries me that there would be a report that would suggest these things rise to that level. But it also made me think what you all thought, how any of this works with injury that hasn't happened, and whether we'd need to do that at all. Whether we'd need to punish attempt aggravated assault if, in fact, really all I did, and I'm not suggesting this is just to speak in current code language, not that necessarily this is how anything would work in the future, but that instead of prosecuting attempt aggravated assault serious bodily injury, you just prosecute the thing that happened, which is significant bodily injury, felony assault. Why would we so anyway, so that stuff, respond to
so
that.
I think there are a few different things there, altered, you know, I think good points worth discussing and addressing. The first is just that, you know, particularly with the intent to kill piece, I mean, I think you're right. We should probably take a look at the footnotes and with these examples and make sure we're not implying anything we don't mean to imply, and to the extent that there are sort of assumptions as to how particular target offenses are going to be revised or what the actus reus of those offenses are going to be, that's something we really need to be attuned to and careful about. That's something that's worth it. Doing another read, and you know, of course, as we revise specific offenses as well, to sort of always make sure that the examples are commensurate. The second thing I think you raised in your comment goes to the issue of you know, like sufficiency of the evidence. Are we making any claims about sufficiency of the evidence under the statutory standard being presented? And, you know, so that's also something worth thinking about. I didn't think so the first time, but definitely worth looking at again. You know, I will say that with these short hypotheticals, the operative assumption is that the facts being asserted are just taken as true. So, like, with respect to the felony assault example and about, you know, where there's a reference to repeatedly beat the intended victim. So, you know, so as to, like, your first point, whether or not repeatedly beating someone, it is possible under current D.C. law to repeatedly beat someone without necessarily rising to felony assault in the completed form. So, like, to the extent that's true, that's a problem, that's something. And to the extent, let's say, that the new definition of felony assault is similar, that's something that should be addressed vis-a-vis the footnote. But, you know, in a lot of attempt prosecutions, right, I mean, in the former ones, at least, you know, there'll be lots of corroborating evidence, including, you know, the one gang member, as part of his rite of initiation, like, he has to go and beat someone to a pulp, and that is you know, let's say that statement introduced in court, and that there is clear evidence that had the police not intervened at the last moment, or whatever the point of dangerous proximity is, that that is what would happen. Or, you know, let's say that a gun is being used, right? That the person is going to shoot the other person in the knee or in the leg. Like, when we have that information, it seems pretty clear that, you know, there, you could say dangerous proximity to causing significant bodily injury. As for your third point, which is the kind of more substantive fundamental policy issue you're raising, concerning whether or not that's something that should be punished as an attempt or something less, you know, I would just say, two things. One, my understanding is that every jurisdiction in America would punish that sort of situation as an attempt, you know, whatever, regardless of whatever the penalties are. What the specific penalties are, you know, matter a lot in terms of whether, if you have very, very low attempt penalties, then, you know, you're just better off prosecuting what actually happened. If something happened, if a completed offense was fulfilled. In other situations, like, so for example, a shoot in this scenario, you may not have very much to prosecute other than the attempt. And, you know, so with respect to penalties, though, right, so if the memorandum doesn't resolve that, or even discuss it, that's something we were, the thinking was that the grading and recommended penalties for all general inquiries should be addressed at one time. It's kind of worth thinking about as a collective whole. So I think that's something that we would probably be releasing in the fall. At the same time, I'd say the general sentiment, I think, you know, at least in terms of national legal trends in these reform jurisdictions, I think like a 50% cut or 70, you know, or 25% cut is the norm. And then, you know, there are a few that, like the MPC, that the MPC recommends just punishing attempts and pleaded defenses identically. That's something that, you know, I think is problematic for, you know, a variety of reasons, and it was not widely embraced by other jurisdictions, that is extremely far from where current district practice is on the issue. It is unlikely to be something that we recommend, but, you know, it just in terms of thinking through this, if, you know, you might keep something like 50%, you know, a 50% cut.
Well,
Michael,
I'm going to, let me interrupt you for a sec. Let me interrupt you. I feel like we should think about this, right? Because part of this is, sorry, I'm supposed to get my kid from camp. Part of the mandate is to, like, think about proportionality and gradations. So going back to burglary, for example, it's either nighttime and it's a house or it's not, right? And that's got, we're not, you know, it's not going to be an attempt house when I broke into a business, right? Like, it is or it isn't. But when we talk about, you know, or it's a child or it's not, but when we're, but I assume, maybe I'm totally wrong, but I assume when we get to assaults, that we probably will have gradations based on level of injury. Maybe we won't, but that's, and maybe I only think we will because that's how DC works now. But then, aren't we perhaps not, don't we have to think about how that works when you could do attempts? And what are we doing in terms of making sure there's gradations and proportionality if there's always this, you can charge this gradation or you can charge attempt and we leave it completely up to you, prosecutor, to apply? I mean, I'm not saying no discretion, but what does that do to the overall it's supposed to fit together? I'm not saying you're going to have an answer right now. It just strikes me that that is, that's part of what's hard about these examples and that particular set of attempts versus gradations.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, this makes sense. I may step in and just say a couple things. One, I do think, you know, we can tighten up the examples, and perhaps it does make sense to simply steer clear from assault-type examples. Some others where, again, you know, like, look, if these were theft type examples with an object would have, of specific value, it would be easier. It would get where we want to go with this. So one, we can do that with examples. We can go through, we can clean those up. But as to your kind of main point about assault, right, and other, you know, kidnapping, sex assault, right, a range of offenses against persons where, right, the degree of harm might be, because things don't play out, it's hard to tell what gradation this fits into. You know, one, I, you know, right, this is a real problem, or it's a problem now, right, under existing law. It's a problem every place because it requires argument and around this question, which is very speculative about intent. So much hinges on that as the only evidence you have since you don't have the actual resulting harm.
Or you do.
Well, you have.
It just isn't. It isn't what you, the attempt you charged me with.
Perhaps.
All I did. Okay.
Yeah. Perhaps. Okay. Right. Right. And again, and I think, you know, Michael mentioned too, weapons is a big part of this. Right. Like our whole assault structure. Right. Kind of jams in ADW. Right. And like, okay. Well, how? You know. Why is it just like a flat thing interposed in there? Shouldn't it be about like, well, is it really elevating the risk? You know, what effect is it having? I think, you know, these are all considerations that we need to bring to bear with assault. There are problems in existing law. There are problems elsewhere too. And yeah, I guess I would just say, you know, if you have thoughts proactively, you know, we're not working on assault right now, but you know, if you see again a model of how to do this in other jurisdictions, a particular kind of carve out, and I follow up with Michael if he's aware of any, but like, you know, what I kind of heard you saying before too, even with the hybrid examples, was can we change the general rule to have some more specific kind of carve-outs for particular maybe offenses or situations. We can look at that if there...
Can I chime in real quick just for one second? Just one thing that's worth being clear about is that the RS... So I think when we were talking about this kind of ties everything together, when we were talking about hybrid possibility, you referenced, or maybe more implicitly referring to like RSP, which specifically addresses hybrid impossibility. But it's worth noting that what the RSP statute does is it allows for the full punishment of RSP regardless of hybrid impossibility, right? And so that's a special carve-out that allows for completed offense liability for hybrid impossibility. It's not a carve-out that's saying where you have a hybrid impossibility that only then is it an attempt. And I'm pretty sure that there's an earlier case, German, the United States, I think, where they said, you know, even if not under the RSP statute, it could always be the sort of, you know, the police decoy stolen property could always be prosecuted as an attempt in any event. So
that's,
you know, and so throughout the DC.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, so we've got examples of that to some degree. But if that's the road we want to go down more, that is available. But this is a more basic question about assault type offenses and the revision there and how attempt fits into that. Again, sex assault, similar issues. We would benefit from you all too, like as a practical matter, how this gets sorted out now, right? You know, in a courtroom level, you know, what do you do? What do you do? The difference between an attempted ag assault and an attempted, you know, felony assault, right? Like, where do you go with that? You know, how are those distinctions made? And like, you know, what we can do to practically do our best to draw some clear lines on this. You know, so we're not there yet. But proactively, it would be helpful, and I think you're raising really important issues in this, and you need to go pick up your child. other thoughts on this? Anyone else want to chime in? Other questions at all on attempts at this stage of the proceedings? If not, any other questions on the penalty enhancements right now, which was also on the agenda?
Right, I had a question. I was just like, been the only one.
Oh, okay, okay.
So I
didn't know what that look meant.
The look was, I could let someone else talk. Okay, unless I'm not going to. Fine. So it's a quick question, and that is, I say it's a quick question, with respect to 805A penalty enhancements. What is equivalent mean here? So you have equivalent later, and you define it. So this is about,
yeah.
Is that the same element? Is that kind of a lesser included analysis? Is that what that's supposed to mean? And is the base offense a gradation?
Sorry, let me pull up the language myself. Sorry. Okay.
It's page 3 of, what is that?
Right.
Report 6. Yeah.
All right, so the question first was on equivalent somewhere here. Equivalent,
when
there
that
we go.
Offense, right.
Right. And the commentary tried to be a bit wiggly on this because I think it is a kind of a wiggly thing, which is to say, I think what we want to avoid is some requirement that it be a verbatim, right? So it's not.
But what it is the element? What is, or what? Or we're wiggling on
an
that
element,
too.
Right? Or again.
Which is equivalent to an element in the penalty
that's
enhancement.
That's right. That's right.
Okay, so that's at least one little addition that would help. Okay, okay, okay.
I'm sorry, in the penalty enhancement.
When the offense contains an element that's equivalent to an element in the penalty enhancement, is that right?
An offense is not subject to a penalty enhancement when the offense contains an element in one of its gradations, which is equivalent to the penalty enhancement. So
when the offense or gradation, right? Has an element that's equivalent to an element that's in the penalty enhancement.
Laura's suggesting a change. She's not reading them.
Okay.
Oh, right. I'm adding words.
Yeah, I'm like,
I'm adding words to say, like, is that what that means?
It gets hard because we have definitions for elements in the other parts of the general provisions, too. So, but I see your point. The idea would be, like, if you had an offense that was, like, financial exploitation of a vulnerable adult. And you were to, or let me do this, maybe.
Child sex, and then there's an enhancement. Right.
Exactly. You wouldn't want to apply the enhancement to the substantive offense in that case.
Right.
That's the intended.
Because there'd be some overlapping elements, and child sex might be your base offense, not a gradation.
That's right. Yeah.
And we mean it there as well. So you don't just mean a gradation as in an add-on. I don't know what a gradation is.
So, right. Partly this is, we have not yet gotten there, but So
what are you proposing to add?
I don't really have a thing.
You want or gradation.
I want gradation. I want the base offense or the gradation. Not
it
just
contains an element.
Okay.
No,
my kids are
no,
right.
Not there.
Right now it talks about gradation. So like if you had child sex as your base offense and then you had an enhancement.
Right.
I mean, yeah, penalty enhancement that was about don't do it against a little kid,
right?
The way I read that, I don't know what a gradation is. You would say, well, that's not the gradation, that's the base offense. So we're going to have child sex against a child as an enhancement. And I think, I assume that's kind of not what they mean. So I just wanted to, that was question slash suggestion. And the other was that we're talking about elements, or I don't know what I don't. I get. Are they called elements in the enhancement?
Yes. So think of it this way. So theft right now, for instance.
Can you talk to my colleague? I'm really
sorry.
Kid arriving.
No worries.
Walks away.
Think about how we're thinking about gradations. Theft right now, you have a general offense, then you have a separate section, first degree, second degree. in those you have the additional element, and it's over $1,000. And so that we would call the gradations of the offense theft. First degree, second degree, two gradations. And we've tucked away in those gradations elements, right? Like in the current statute, that's the way it's done. Our thought in how we're right now drafting, it's a drafting issue more than anything, property offenses and going forward, is we have a general offense, for instance, theft. It would be the same thing, you know, taking, exercising control over property of another, you know, without consent of the owner or something like this, right? That's your base offense. And then you have a first degree, you know, and then you have a list of gradations. First degree theft is when you commit the base offense plus the value of the property is over, you know, X dollars. Second degree is this plus the value of the harvest. So that's the kind of structure. Now, it's certainly absolutely right that, like, we can clarify this a bit better, or need to think more generally about how we're talking about comparing. We want the enhancements to be right. The conceptual difference is just like if it's provided for in the offense and its gradation somewhere in there, right? If it's part of the conceptual scheme in the development of the theft offense that we're dealing with the value of the property, well, then if we have a penalty enhancement, which also was about just about the value of the property involved, that would not apply. That's all we're trying to like do. And could we be clear on drafting? Probably could. We'll take a look at that. So for Laura, wherever you are right now, this is, you know, we hear you.
Yeah. Just trying to double, triple.
Exactly. We're just trying to like clean that up. So exactly.
So we got to be careful in the language.
Exactly. And that's right. And we want to be careful on that. And that was the goal, was to avoid the multiples of multiples thing. And it comes up too, right? Not just gradations, but.
But it's like Wallon, possession of a firearm during the commission of a
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
We're going to see this.
Exactly.
As we're thinking about it. Different places.
That's right. And in general, right now, like, it's a problem with the current statutes that they just don't address this, like, stacking on stack. You know, like, can you have multiple enhancements? Exactly. It's not used as, you know, the few statistics which we were able to get again. We don't have charging statistics, but from what we can tell for the felony, you know, sentencing statistics, right? All of these, you know, it's kind of all about the wild arm enhancement, right? Like, that's what actually is being applied to felony sentences. The rest of this, I mean, we see some for seniors and minors, a significant number, I would say. These others, though, really rare. Really rare, and even when they do are attached, they aren't actually boosting the penalties above the otherwise applicable statutory max. So now this may shift, and I particularly would say the recidivist enhancement is a big deal, because in some sense I think, you know, the recidivist enhancement could be applied a lot, right? Most defendants have, you know, some criminal history. Many have significant criminal histories. We have some very severe recidivist enhancements on the books. If we reshape penalties to be more proportionate, at least, you know, what that means, different people are going to disagree, but even if it were brought simply into line with existing practice, that might change kind of functionally how in plea bargaining those come into play. So I just, you know, while this enhancement isn't doing much work now, if you shift statutory penalties, it could come into play. So that's why I think it deserves particular attention. But and same thing, frankly, for all of these. You know, BJS, I think today had a, like, it was today or yesterday, I'm already Augie, but like had some new report, like, you know, half of hate crimes nationally are actually, like, you know, reported, and, like, you know, we see very few hate crime enhancements being actually applied in felony sentencing. Now, depending on how where the other reforms end up, you know, charging practice may change, right? And sentencing practice may change. And these are big ways that, again, they aren't used now, or they're rarely used, but could significantly shift things. So that's why we wanted to get this out here and say this should be part of the puzzle as everybody, like, starts to think about how the whole thing works together. These are going to be available. Now, how much is it going to, you know, how much is the enhancement going to be? One thing I just emphasize again, although these distinctions right now are made for a lot of these, pretty much throughout these, between a misdemeanor felony and a crime of violence levels, those distinctions are kind of all for naught if, for instance, you know, the penalty is, you know, it bumps up one class, right? So from a 5-year a felony to the next class up a 10-year felony. Or from a 180-day misdemeanor to 1 year. If it's always, you know, anyway, so these distinctions, although we're making them now and they might be relevant, depending on the penalty that's attached, right, we'll get to that towards the end, they all may be a wash. And we may just say, hey, it's you increase by one class whatever the penalty otherwise would have been. And that will scale up at the misdemeanor level and at the felony level, so we don't need this level of distinction. But we don't know that at this point. So we kind of drew this as the kind of maximum set of distinctions that we would want to draw, and to show the scope that it would include, for instance, misdemeanors at the bottom, which one of our two current statutes does and the other doesn't. I could answer more questions about that, or Bryson could, but anything else anybody wants to raise, or we can call it a meeting. All right, then. Hopefully we still have folks on the phone who made it to the end. Thank you all for bearing with our technical difficulties, and we're happy to meet individually and address any of this. And again, proactively thinking about, like, yeah, how is this going to work out for assaults or murder? We'd love to have that conversation. That will help us. So, yeah, we're always happy to meet on that. So just let us know. Thank you all, and, yeah, have a good rest of the summer if we don't see you till September. Good breaks. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.